This week, the Clarets face Newcastle in a home game that was billed as many as a must not lose. This is the Known and Ever podcast. Hello, welcome back, listeners. Normal service is resumed. I am back. Did you miss me? I'm pretty sure you did. Listeners, for those of you who don't follow me on social media, I have been absent from the Known and Ever podcast for a couple of weeks. The guys very happily gave me a couple of weeks leave so I could go swan off and sun myself in the beaches of the Bahamas while you guys grounded away at the cold, wet, windy Burnley to try and get us through this difficult patch. But I have returned. A quick note from me just to say thank you to producer Matt for jumping in and really helping us out while I was away on leave. We had kind of debated having to miss the podcast with the new team and obviously being a little bit depleted in terms of personnel this season, but Matt really stepped up and really helped us out. And Robbie and Dave as well, both, you know, pitched in and got us the episodes out for the last couple of weeks. So thanks to the team. This is definitely a team effort, and I'm really grateful for the boys that we have around us at Known and Ever to try and get out the podcasts every week. So let's get back to normal. And this week we have a slight change in personnel in that Robbie's not with us this week now. I tell you, we've not got a full lineup for ages. We're going to be like, Deitch and tinkering around with our injuries in the podcast. But we are joined by resident statistician and my absolute fave, Dave Roberts. Dave, good evening and welcome back to the show.
Good evening, Natalie. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right. We've got lots to talk about this week, actually. I feel a little fresh, listeners. I feel like we've got some renewed enthusiasm and we're going to plough through last night's result. And we've got a couple of things to talk about as well. So we're going to start by looking at last night's loss at home to Newcastle, which I'm sure we're all incredibly disappointed about. But we're going to go through it and we're going to dissect what went wrong. And we're going to have a look to the future and how we can put this right. We've got a couple of things to talk about off the pitch as well, certainly with the new technical director who is joining us this Saturday at Turf Moor. And a small matter of a payment to a certain Premier League official who will be stepping down at the end of this season, which has got everybody a little bit riled. So let's move on and let's start with the game and let's get straight into it. Now, as a slight change in format, producer Matt this week asked Robbie and I to have a go at recording a little feature for you all, which was our immediate post-match reaction, which, as you can imagine, was met with some cynicism by me and Robbie, because both of us are quite emotional when it comes to Burnley. And when you've just come off a result like that and you're literally right outside Turf Moor in the freezing cold and Matt saying, record your immediate reaction, we were a little worried that it wasn't going to be particularly constructive. But we persisted and we did it. And here is the result. So, Natalie and Robbie are outside of Turf Moor. We have just finished Burnley against Newcastle, and producer Matt has asked us to give our initial match reaction, and we are both cold and deflated. But Robbie has just told me that that's the most entertaining game of football he's seen in ages. Robbie, explain yourself.
Well, I witnessed Ashley Barnes take a corner in injury time. I then witnessed Joe Hart play central midfield and pull all the strings. He was better than Jack. I bet his pass completion rate was better than Jack Hawks tonight.
I think it was as well. I feel like I've got to laugh, otherwise I'm going to cry. That's my initial thing going out there. I don't know whether it's just complete, terrified things of the result, or the fact that we're in a really precarious position, or the fact that we just can't score, or just the comedy nature of that first goal. I don't know what it is, but Robbie, it's a result though, isn't it?
To be fair, I thought after we went 1-0 down, I thought the response was actually really good.
I thought we
passed the move with a bit of tempo, we got it out wide, and then we conceded another sloppy goal. And then at 2-0, I thought we were a bit deflated after that.
I think going forward, we did all right, didn't we? It was just defensively, we just don't look
at
ourselves.
I said to the guys around me, I thought on the ball, I thought we were actually quite good. It was just where we just didn't press as a unit, and we looked a bit lost. And then, the second goal is just a killer for us.
We did get it back. I think
that come from nothing
as well. Exactly. I think getting that first goal back before half time probably does the world good. Although I do worry that it maybe meant that we didn't make the changes we probably should have made at half time.
Yeah, it's, I noticed there were no like warming up until like 7:15
exactly.
either.
No,
that
I agree.
Was,
it was
that
very
was
weird.
Really strange. Like, have you heard of this Vidra fella? Who's this Vidra?
I don't know. What is a Vidra?
I don't know.
I've heard it's an endangered species. I don't know what it is, but anyway. But that's it. That is immediate match reaction from Natalie and Robert. We are freezing cold. We are going to go home and sulk for a bit. And then we're going to record a proper podcast tomorrow. So we'll see you in a bit.
So, yeah. So there you go, Dave. That was Robbie and my immediate reaction. I kind of love the fact, Dave, that our voices are all really croaky and harsh because we've always been shouting in the cold for 2 hours. Just to add on to the back of that, obviously, I think Robbie was a little bit delirious with enthusiasm. I was just laughing my head off because I didn't know what else to do. But if you can try and put yourself back into the mind frame of immediately coming off the turf last night, what were your immediate reactions to that game?
I'm not sure I want to be honest. But yeah, seeing as I'm here on the podcast, I better add, hadn't I? I was really disappointed that we gave Newcastle such a head start. You know, giving any team a two-goal start as we did, but you know, scoring the first and the second goals and being two goals behind in the game, that was going to be an uphill battle from then on. I think after that, Burnley got back into the game. I mean, the goal, fantastic goal from Sam Vokes. You don't see many strikers scoring headers from that distance out. So that kind of got us back into the game a little bit. But yeah, just overall, the disappointment that we'd let ourselves down, given Newcastle two goals early on, and just made it really difficult for ourselves.
Yeah, I think that was probably my biggest disappointment as well, Dave. It was such a key battle, and it was one that I didn't expect it to be a particularly entertaining game just because of the importance of the game. You know, Newcastle have just won, what, 3 back-to-back results, so they've really given themselves a fighting chance in this league now, whereas we're kind of on the back foot and really trying to dig ourselves out of a hole we've put ourselves in at the moment. So to make it as easy as we did for them was a little disappointing for me. Now, let's start with that, because the first goal was it's always horrendous to score such an early goal. But to be fair, it was a pretty unlucky goal to concede, don't you think?
Yeah, it was totally a fluky goal, took a deflection, and you know, there's nothing that Joe Hart could have done about that one. And just one of those things, but a real killer early on, you know, fourth minute, really early in the game. And it's really difficult when you go out there with a mindset to, you know, try and build on that clean sheet we got at Leicester. And then to concede so early on was disappointing.
Do you think there was anything that the defence could have done differently? I mean, when I looked at it in real time, I kind of had this feeling in the back of my mind that we were a little lethargic in trying to get to the ball, and we maybe weren't as sharp to close down on the edge of the box to give them the chance to have the shoot in the first place. But I don't know if I'm being a little bit unfair there.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I've not had a chance to watch the full highlights through again. The club, I don't think, have posted them on the website. They did put the match day compilation on there, the sort of arty one that they do, which kind of shows it from a different angle. But yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it? I think it is just one of those things. It's taking a deflection, and you know, you've got to put that down to experience. But I think the killer really was the second goal. I think to concede the second goal, go two goals down after that first goal so early on, that was, you know, always going to be a really, really difficult task for Burnley.
Yeah. I do think we defended quite poorly for that second goal. That was a really disappointing goal to concede. It just felt like nobody was taking responsibility for clearing that ball. And as reliable as Ben Mee has been forever, we just didn't see the Ben Mee that we're used to seeing, who will literally throw his head in front of a boot to stop a ball from going in. Even he was a little, I don't know if I can even be arsed with this. Do you know, it was just one of those weird moments where nobody seemed to take responsibility.
Yeah, it was sloppy, I think. I think it was alluded to in the post-match interviews as well. And, you know, it's one of those things we have to try and cut out when there are such fine margins in the game, as we keep being told, then for something like that to happen is going to be really difficult to turn around. You know, 2-0 lead for any team is a really dominant position to be in. I mean, we got ourselves back into the game. You know, Newcastle had the chance in the second half. I mean, I don't know how they didn't score another one. They had, a sitter in front of goal, one that came clean back off the post as well. And, you know, a possible open goal late on when Burnley were going for that equaliser. But I think Sean Dyche came out in his post-match interview and said, you know, maybe Burnley were a little bit unlucky and could have got a point out of it. I think that's being a little bit generous. I think when you look at the balance of play, yes, you know, you look at the stats, and the stats suggest that maybe it was close than it actually was. But I think when you actually watch the game, sometimes the stats, you hear this one from me, the stats don't tell the entire story. And I think on the balance of the game, I think most neutrals would say that Newcastle probably did deserve to win it.
Oh, God, absolutely, yeah. When I heard Dyche at the end of the game, well, it was a funny one, really, because I was fully expecting him to come out on the PR offensive, and he said exactly what I expected him to say. And whilst I absolutely 100% never expect him to come out and criticise his players, and I would, in fact, be very disappointed if he did, to hear him come out and say it was a fine margin and we deserve something out of the game, and he's kind of scratching his head to find out how we didn't get something, I'm a bit, oh, Sean, really, you know, like you can dress it up in a better way without making yourself sound like you've lost the plot a little bit. I think that worries fans, because not all fans can see that in a common sense light and realise that Dyche has got to be the front man, and he's got to portray positivity, he's got to protect the club's brand, he's got to protect his players, and I 100% support him on that, no question. But not every fan sees that, and you know, that just intensifies and the, I guess, frustration that fans are feeling at the moment, and a feeling that everything's not quite right. I've got to say, actually, when you were saying there about 2-0 being a dominant position for most teams to be in, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think 2-0 is a very vulnerable scoreline in the Premier League, but I wonder whether we're seeing some of our Premier League naivety creeping back in that we had maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and that I thought we'd completely eradicated last year. It seems to me whenever we're 2-0 up, I'm never fully convinced that we're going to win the game, because 2-0 results get overturned all the time in the Premier League. And we've had it ourselves where we've been 2-0 up and lost a game 3-2. But it feels completely the opposite way around when we're 2-0 down, and I just don't ever have any confidence that we're going to come back from it, apart from the odd exception. And last night, for all of the, well, I guess Chris Bowden said it, for all of the huffing and puffing, I'm not even sure we had that much huffing and puffing, to be honest, but for all of the intensity and the desire in the closing minutes of both halves, I never really felt we were going to turn that around. That said, Dave, I thought our reaction in the closing minutes, closing, say, 5 to 7 minutes of the second half, I thought we were really excellent.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit hair and scare at times, wasn't it, with I'd like to see Joe Hart's average position in the last 5 minutes, because he was playing sort of sweeper, central midfield, going up to be a striker at one point. It was interesting, to say the least. But yeah, I mean, can't say that we didn't give it all in the last few minutes. But you know, was it a little bit too little, too late? We only made two substitutions. Both of those came on the 82nd minute. We had Ashley Barnes and Jeff Hendrick coming on, and you know, didn't give them too long to have an impact on the game.
Yeah, there's a couple of points there that you've just picked up on that I want to turn back to our listeners, because we had a few tweets in that we picked up from social media along those same lines, which really made me laugh. And I think Ben Kilbride really summed this up for me when he was talking about that last 5 minutes. And he tweeted initially, like, Barnes on a last minute corner, I'm going to bleep this word, give up. And then literally, it must have been stewing over it, because maybe an hour or so later, he would just tweet and said, I'm still not over this. That last 5 minutes or so was embarrassing. It was amateur hour. And it did feel like that. It felt like absolute desperation to me, Dave. I don't know whether or not you found any humour in that last 5 minutes, or whether you were just absolutely appalled.
I think it was a little bit with Joe Hart's play, I guess that. I mean, Rock came across, didn't it, in Robbie's piece that he did with you after the game. But, I mean, it's... Yeah, if you didn't laugh about it, you'd probably cry. It's one of those things where, yeah, we went for it. Sam Vokes had that chance right at the end, you know, the header, the last touch of the game, wasn't it, in the end? So the referee's whistle went straight after us, but just couldn't keep his header down. You know, Birmingham might have got an equaliser at the end, might have got a point out of it, and we might have been talking a little bit differently now. But, you know, I think on the balance of play, the 2-1 result to Newcastle was probably a fair reflection of the game. And I think Sean Dyche thought otherwise. He thought that maybe we could have got a point out of it. I think that's probably spinning it a little bit too much. I think most Burnley fans would perhaps differ with the manager on that one.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Again, one of the second points you said in your summary then, Dave, we were talking about the substitutions, which you picked up on. Chris Horner was one of the fans to tweet, and he said that, you know, we were 2-0 down at home and it takes 80 minutes into the game to make a substitution. Now, what's the point in spending a wedge of money on players like Vidra and then let them sit on the bench for the whole of the game? Playing Wood and Volks together is illogical to me. Now, there are a few things in that tweet that I want to pick up on, because these are some of the notes that I made from the game last night. 3 points. Number one, substitutions and why it did take him so long. And in the end, he just kind of went like for like. I didn't really think we had much impact with our subs. Number two, the Vidra situation. And then number three, the strikers generally. So let's start with the substitution piece, shall we? I thought he left the substitutions way too late last night, even for Dyche. And we do know he's not a fan of quick substitutions.
Yeah, I think maybe introducing Hendrick, with hindsight, you know, having Hendrick on earlier might have given us more penetration. I mean, throughout the game, I thought we didn't get much penetration down the wings. We obviously had Robbie Brady playing. You know, Johan Berg-Gudmundsson was ill. He couldn't play. Robbie Brady started the game, and we had Aaron Lennon. I think Aaron Lennon played quite a deep role. Robbie Brady didn't really make too many inroads. I thought perhaps we should have tried to get more along the wings with those two players, and I don't think either of them were able to do that. I mean, Aaron Lennon, don't get me wrong, he put a real shift in, and there were times when he was doing a lot of defensive work, but we didn't see too much, or as much as we would have liked to have seen from him going forward. And I think that perhaps let us down a little bit. We weren't getting enough service in from the two wingers. That's I think we did miss JBG last night. I think his absence was definitely seen. In terms of the substitutions, yeah, I think, you know, perhaps we should have had gone for it a little bit sooner. We did go for it, you know, the last 8 minutes, and particularly the last 2 or 3 minutes. You know, Burnley were throwing everything at it. You know, almost got caught and conceded another one as a result. But should we have perhaps given that a more concerted effort from, you know, 70, 75 minutes? You know, that's perhaps something we should have looked at. It's one of those things. It's gone now. The difficulty is we've got, you know, got some really tough games coming up. You know, they're all tough in the Premier League, but I guess you're looking at Crystal Palace and the Brighton game as the two that are perhaps the most likely to get points out of. Apart from that, we're playing top six sides, aren't we, in and around the lead up to Christmas?
Yeah, we've got a really horrific run of games coming up at the moment. I think that's one of the reasons why most fans were really hoping for 3 points last night. Certainly, I think not a loss, anything. I think even a draw might have been a little worrying, but a loss was an awful result. The Lennon situation that you picked up on there, Dave, was really weird. He was practically playing in right back for vast majorities of that game. And a lot of the times I was looking out there when we were 2-1 down and we were playing almost Matt Lawton and Kevin Long and Ben Mee in the middle with Taylor and Aaron Lennon at fullbacks. And it was just, it was bizarre to see that just the defensive setup that we had, even when we were 2-1 down and we were trying to chase a game at home, a game that we shouldn't really, well, we really couldn't lose. It was very odd. So because of that, because the game was so defensive, which, you know, is no great surprise for a Sean Dyche side, we do have to discuss this striker situation. And I think this is one of the ones that Chris picked up on in his tweet. Now, listeners will know that I'm really not a fan of lumping two of our big guys up front whenever we choose to play 4-4-2. Any combination for me of Wood, Barnes and Volks playing together up front just does not work. They're too similar. They have to try and get the ball, pick a ball up from a hoof ball over the top. And then when they get that, they've got nobody to lay it onto. And they're usually about 40 yards away from goal when they do that anyway. And I'm really not a fan. I think we need one holding player and a classic number 10 to be able to actually put it in the net. Chris Wood is not fulfilling that role at the moment, for whatever reason that will be, and his confidence looks like it's completely vanished. But oh look, if only, Dave, we hadn't have gone into the transfer window in the summer and actually paid £15 million for one of the Championship's leading goal scorer last season and a classic number 10. Except we did. But he can't get on the pitch. Dave, what is a Vidra?
A mythical creature.
Yes, quite.
it does seem an odd one. I mean, you know, again, caveats on this. We don't see what goes on the the training ground. You know, is it a tactical thing? Is it a fitness thing? We've seen before players have come in and, you know, there's a thinking that, you know, they're not fully match fit or Deitch fit. I don't know. You know, it is puzzling for some of us to, or for many of us, I think, to see that and have a player who, you know, has been presumably brought in for that role. I mean, we've seen Jeff Hendrick try to play that role and struggle a little bit, and he's kind of had to, you know, try and adapt to that role with difficulty. And, you know, that's been conceded by the manager at times, that he's you know, he's trying to do that with Jeff Hendrick. But with Matty Vidra, you've got a player coming in who supposedly is that player. He, you know, that's the way he plays, and, you know, it's we've not had that chance, to see that too much. You know, we've seen him once, twice. He obviously scored, didn't he, on his Burnley debut at Turf Moor as well, coming on as a substitute in the Europa League match. But we've not seen as much of him as we might have expected to see at this point in the season. So whether it's a fitness thing, I don't know. But it appears from a layman in the stands that, you know, that's what should be happening, and we're not seeing it. So, you know, do we need some clarification on that? You know, I don't know. That might be something to think about. I mean, we're not there to ask questions in the pre-match press conferences. Perhaps that might be something that Chris Bowden or some of the other guys from the press might pick up on in the next pre-match, which is going to be, I think they do them Thursday for the Saturday game, so it's only a day or two away.
Yeah, well, I certainly think that I want the questions answered. And if people don't start asking those questions, I might have to fight my way in. Do you think I'll get a lifetime ban if I fight my way into the press room and pretend that I'm some kind of press? Do you think none and never editor gets me in? I think it should. I might just body in. Well, actually, interesting, we've got Chris Bowden coming on the podcast in the next few weeks to be our panellist for the game, which I'm really excited about, because I think we can grill him on matters such as this. And obviously, we've got to be very aware that Chris will be privy to information that's not necessarily for public view, and also he will be mindful of his position and his relationship with the club. So I'm not expecting a complete, you know, Jeremy Kyle show tell all, but I certainly think Chris is one of the better journalists for pressing the club and asking the difficult questions in the right context and, you know, mindful of his relationships with the club. So we will certainly ask those questions. The final point, just before we start moving on to I guess wider things, Chris Wood's confidence has vanished with that reset button. I don't know where it is, but somewhere in the world, somebody is hiding our reset button and Chris Wood's confidence, and we need to go on a treasure hunt to find them and bring them back. Because Dave, he looks an absolute shadow of the player that showed so much promise last season, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, when he came in, he was scoring goals for fun, and there was, you know, a real confidence in the side, and he had confidence in his play, and he, you know, was scoring, you know, almost every other game, wasn't he, for us? You know, had a once or twice where he was out with injuries last season as well, but you thought this season he's back in and he's going to be back to those levels, and he hasn't, you know, hit those heights anywhere near yet. We need to see Chris Wood coming back and you know, doing what we know he's capable of. You know, we've got striking options at the club now, you know, compared to going back a few seasons. I think the criticism was with, you know, the first couple of seasons we had in the Premier League, that we didn't have the depth of the squad. We do have more options in all positions now, and that includes up front as well. But, you know, goal scoring is one of the areas where we are struggling. I mean, it's interesting. I don't think our goal scored is that much different to last season, but the fact that we've conceded 27 in the Premier League, that's obviously been the flip side of it. And, you know, you can get by scoring maybe a goal a game if you're keeping clean sheets every other game. You can't if you're shipping, you know, two goals a game on average, which is what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, good point, Dave. I think that's obviously what's going on at the moment, is that our defence just looks an absolute shadow. In fact, I hear that from so many fans from other clubs. It's one of the first questions that they ask me. They just say, what on earth has happened to your defence? And believe me, listeners, we're scratching our heads as well. We're not sure what's going on. Actually, interestingly, talking about defence, there was a slightly niggly reaction between Ben Mee and the fans, which I'm not going to draw a massive issue with, just because Ben Mee is a much-loved player of our club. He's our deputy captain when Tom Heaton's not around. And he has fought for this club. And in some respects, I can kind of understand where he was coming from. But there was a slight altercation with him and the fans at the end, in that as the final whistle went, and obviously we were trying to score at the cricket, at the Beall End, we went to cricket with the Beall End. A selection of fans in the lower tier did hurl a little bit of abuse at the players' ways, and there was some booing from that section. And Ben Mee sort of snapped in a very mild sense and turned to those fans and gesticulated at them and did tell them to expletive, which he has come out on Instagram and apologised for today. Ben Mee doesn't have Twitter, so you won't have seen it on Twitter, but on his Instagram page he said, "I'm massively gutted about tonight's result. Just wanted to apologise for my reaction to a few fans stood next to me at the final whistle. Pure frustration on my part, UTC." So I'm going to mention it just because it was an event that happened after the game, but we're not going to dwell on it. We're not going to talk about it. I would much rather our players get frustrated by a result than not actually care. So Ben Mee, if you're listening, which obviously you are, stick with it, lad. We'll get through this together. And you've said your piece. Let's move on and let's disappear. So with that in mind, we're going to move on as well. And the best way that we could sort of look at, you'll see the title of this week's podcast is Somebody's Broken the Reset Button, essentially. And we are clearly struggling this season. Things are not going well. There's rumours on and off the pitch that there's problems on the pitch and off the pitch in the dressing room, that somehow Dyche has lost the dressing room, that somehow there's some unrest, there's players fighting, there's a ridiculous rumour going around that Tarkowski got hit by Dyche, which is quite frankly the most ludicrous piece of gossip I've ever heard in my life, and it's clearly not right. But there's all sorts, and there's a lot of tittle-tattle going around, and I think I give those examples as just the blatant panic nature that's going around. But last night, one of our listeners, Becca Stubbs, tweeted a really good summary, actually, that I want to use as a basis for a wider discussion as to what is going wrong this season. And there were 5 points to her note, and I'm going to read them out in order, actually, and we'll talk through them as we're going along. So, Dave, if you can get your thinking cap on, and we are going to discuss these. So, point number one from Becca Stubbs. The 11 that got us into the Europa League didn't get a chance to play in a competition they'll probably never get the chance to play in again. Why would they now fight for the rewards if they don't get a chance to reap them? Now, this is something that a few people have raised, Dave, and this potential rationale for a loss of mental spirit and that loss of togetherness that we felt we had last season can perhaps be blamed on some managerial decisions from Dyche and perhaps broken that bond between them. Thoughts, Dave?
I'm not sure I go along with that. I mean, looking at last season as a whole, Burnley finished seventh, fantastic season, you know, beyond our wildest dreams, and obviously the European campaign. But we've got to be realists about it. I think we don't have, you know, the biggest, the strongest squad to deal with a European campaign and a Premier League campaign. So we had to utilise the squad, and I was all for that. I think I didn't talk about individuals, but I think generally speaking, I go along with that. I think what you have to do is kind of roll that back a little bit and look at Burnley had a really good start to last season, you know, leading up to, you know, probably the Stoke game, we went fourth in the table. Beyond that, we had a poor run, didn't we, in the early part of 2018. We went 10 or 11 games, I think it was, without a victory. We had quite a few draws in there, but couldn't get a win. We then had 5 consecutive wins, and then we had another run right at the end of the season where, again, we didn't get another victory. So it was kind of a little bit up and down in that second half of the season, but we did enough to get us over the line, get us that seventh place. But we have to be realistic about it. We're not going to be a side that are going to be, you know, pushing seventh, fifth, sixth, fifth, fourth every season, all season. It's we worked remarkably hard. We had some fantastic results in the first half of the season. We did enough in the second half of the season to continue that momentum. But Burnley are a side who are, you know, we're not guaranteed anything in this division. You look at the so-called Big Six, And, we even see some of them struggling. We had, Chelsea a couple of seasons back. We've got Manchester United, probably to a lesser extent this season, struggling as well. So there's no givens in the division. So we have to be realistic about it. I think we've got to think, where have we come from, and not get too big for our boots to some extent. So I think we're perhaps looking too deep into it to say, well, this has happened and, X, Y, and Z. Whereas in reality, it's perhaps reverting back to the mean a little bit, and we have to realise that, we don't have the entitlement to be a top 6-7 side in the division. We've got to work hard week in, week out for every single result for every game. And it's difficult the way it's gone the start of this season. And, things haven't looked right. There's been times where things haven't looked right. But I think we've got to have confidence in the players. We know what they're capable of. We've got to have confidence in the player and the players and the manager to turn things around, really.
What a great answer. I literally have nothing to add to that. You absolutely nailed that one. So point number two then, let's move on. This is, Becca, you make some amazing points in this one. And I don't think she's necessarily saying that this is the case, but she's offering it as a suggestion. But I've got to say, listeners, I'm getting a little tired with the wide number of reasons to blame Joe Hart for everything that's going on in this club. It seems every week he doesn't come out and catch the ball. He punches a ball too much. He doesn't command his area. He doesn't shout at the players. He's upset the club captain. He's blah, 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 blah. Last night he was trying to come up for corners, and it's embarrassing. And I'm just... anyway. But point number two is... bringing in Joe Hart could have upset the club captain and could have changed the dressing room harmony for the worse. So this is a slightly different point, and there's obviously an underlying bubbling problem going on with Tom Heaton, in that if rumours are to be believed, there's clearly been some kind of bust-up between him and the management at the side, and he's clearly very unhappy at being left out of the side. People fully expect Nick Pope to come back into the first team when he returns to fitness very shortly, leaving Joe Hart as number two, and probably Tom Heaton leaving in January. We had another tweet to back this up, who was, if you just bear with me a second, Dan in Prague, who's a regular listener of the show. Hello, Dan. No, no, never. He says, I can't help but feel that Hart has been a disruptive factor in the dressing room and we need to move him on in January. So Dan goes even further than Becca and says that actually Joe Hart needs to go. We need to go back to having Pope and Heaton. Let's leave aside the what can we blame Joe Hart for this week, Dave. I'm going to leave, in fact, I'm not even going to concentrate on this being a Joe Hart problem. Let's widen this to the overall feel of the club, because for whoever's responsible and whatever's caused it, this team does not feel as together as it did, and there doesn't seem to be the same relationship with Dyche and the players. Do you think we have got a harmony problem?
I think there's maybe more of a confidence problem. I think the one thing, with hindsight, looking back over last season, having a really good start to the season gives you a different perspective. I think the fact that where we were in the table takes the pressure off, players can play differently. Whereas if you are at the other end of the table and you're struggling for results like we are this season, you play differently. I think you have a different outlook on the game. So I don't know whether that's a factor in it. Having a really good start was a really good bonus for us last season. Probably even from October, November, we weren't really worried about where we're going to be. And you're looking up, always looking up rather than looking down. Whereas now, the difficulties we've had at the start of the season, for whatever reason, and fairness to the manager, they can be fine margins within the division. I think we've been below that. I don't think it's been just that. I think there's been other difficulties as well. But I think it's a confidence division. Sometimes at other clubs, a change of manager's done it. I mean, I'm not for one second suggesting that's the case at Burnley, because I don't think there's anyone I'd rather have at the football club getting us out of this. You do see and hear people suggesting that, Sean Dyche is the issue and we're going to get rid of Sean Dyche. But, with what the guy's done, what the guy's capable of, he's there for the long term at Burnley Football Club, and he's going to get us out of that, out of this situation this season. But other clubs, I can fully see why They've changed the manager. I mean, our next opponent's Crystal Palace. Look at the start they had to last season. They had, I think it was 7 defeats in the first 7 games. They hadn't even scored a goal. They turned it around, and I think they finished 11th in the end, didn't they, in the division last season. So we're well clear of it in the end. So it can be a confidence thing, and it is really difficult that for them in that position to turn things around was, you know, miraculous. We're nowhere near that. I think there are several teams who I think we're more than capable of finishing above this season. We're going to have to beat some of them later on in the season in the games we play against them. But, you know, the manager we've got is the right man to get us out of it. We just need to have confidence in the team and push on, because those results are going to come.
I think my biggest concern with the results is the fixtures. Now, in the Premier League, I tend to look for the last 10 fixtures first on fixture release day. Because when you are outside the top seven and you are expecting to be not necessarily a direct relegation scrap, but, you know, on the wrong side of the top half, even those finishing 13th, 14th will be looking over their shoulder. If you have a bad run of 10 games, then you better make sure you've got the points on the board by March. And it just concerns me that we've got a really, really tough last running of 10 games. So if we not get these points on the board soon and pull ourselves away from relegation, we could be in serious trouble way before people realise we are, because we need to get these points on the board by March 100%. Now, one of the ways that you can get points on the board and actually win games, Dave, is investment. Now, point number three that Becca says on her summary was, our lack of investment is embarrassing. We had an extra competition, and even without that, it was obvious we needed depth. Now, this is a ongoing complaint that Burnley fans have got, especially with the board. The board seem to be taking the whole brunt of it, but I would offer the, I guess, reality that Sean Dyche isn't completely blameless in that transfer window. He has vetoed certain signings where he felt that the players weren't worth it or the market was massively inflated. And we're going to come on to talk about the new technical director and his role with that, certainly later on in the podcast. But a few tweets that we saw last night did, reiterate this view. I think Chris Borden and Patrick Walton had an exchange of tweets on the show where they were talking about us being the poorest team in the league, and Chris Borden was saying that the problem that we've got at the moment is we've got no options to replace wide players unless you put McNeil on the bench, but obviously he knows that Vidra's absence is a puzzler. And Pat Walton just turned around and said, well, if only there was some kind of transfer window and a £100 million of cash above and beyond what we generate naturally, that obviously would have helped. So a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but obviously we do get the point. One good point, actually, that Chris Horner said that I want you to pick up on, Dave. The board get criticism often correctly, but they sanction a big money signing like Vidra and he doesn't even see a minute and plays on the bench. They must be thinking, why bother? Now, David Whitney is maybe not as polite with that, and he just basically says that we had the staggering levels of complacency in the summer transfer market led us to this problem. So we've got two conflicting views there. We've got the view that the responsibility is squarely on the board's shoulders, and our lack of investment in the summer has basically caused this. On an opposing view, as well, what's the point in spending money when Dyche is making some bizarre tactical decisions when it comes to players and leaving players like Vidra, who has got the pace and the creativity we are desperate for, and leaving them on the bench? Which side of the argument do you fall down on, Dave?
I think that there's a certain merit in both of those arguments, in that it can be difficult in the transfer market. We are sort of building our levels up, and I think there's always, I think, a little bit of reticence from the point of view of, you know, the vast sums of money that are involved. Because, you know, we don't have, you know, a foreign multimillionaire pumping millions into the club. We have fairly rich, in layman's comparison, in terms of the guys who are Burnley fans, who are in charge of the club. We don't have someone who's a, you know, a foreign multi-billionaire like many of the Premier League teams now have. You know, Manchester City or Liverpool or Arsenal could, you know, quite easily spend, you know, £100 million in a blink of an eye, whereas that's never going to happen at Burnley. We're building up in terms of what we're prepared to do. I think in terms of the wages of players, which has been, you know, the salaries involved has been a stumbling block, and we're kind of catching up on that level. And the same in transfer fees as well, although the transfer fees. You know, our transfer record is still sort of, I think we're up to sort of 15, 16 million for the most we spent on a player. You know, we're not going to spend 30, 40 million pounds on a player. So you are trying to fish in a certain pond in terms of the market you can go for. You know, and even, you know, Championship players, you know, they're costing 15 million pounds when we're buying them. You know, we bought two of them, haven't we? We've got Ben Gibson and Matteo Vidra coming in on that sort of level in terms of the transfer fees. With Ben Gibson, it's been different. Obviously, there's been injuries involved. With Matteo Vidra, you know, obvious injuries that's been publicised. With Matteo Vidra, it's not been quite as clear as we've already discussed earlier. But yeah, there is a certain amount of thinking to say, well, you know, we've spent the money on players and yet we haven't got the value for that in terms of them coming on the pitch and delivering, you know, the value for that investment. You know, you may have to go up a step further in terms of spending, you know, double what we've ever paid for a player to get that sort of impact. And, you know, that going down the line, that may well happen. But you get the feeling that we're going to do it in stages. We're not going to just suddenly push the boat out and it's going to suddenly be, right, you know, Burnley have spent 30 million or 40 million in a transfer window. I can't see us doing that in January. I don't know what you think about that, Natalie.
No. Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on what this new director of football is going to do, what Rigg's going to do when he comes in, which we'll have a look. In fact, let's talk about this now, actually, because it feels like a natural time. The Clarets have appointed... what's his first name? Mike Rigg. I wonder what his first name. I want to call him Stephen for some reason. The announcement basically said that Burnley Football Club is delighted to announce the appointment of Mike Rigg as a technical director. He's had a variety of high-profile roles within domestic and international football, and he's going to head up the process of talent identification and recruitment throughout the whole club, from the academy to the first team. Now, that to me is quite welcome news, Dave, because one of the things that I've been perhaps concerned with and a little perplexed by is this very strange relationship and the roles between Deitch and Mike Garlick and their very hands-on approach to their recruitment. And it almost felt like it was just getting too narrow and they were not maybe seeing things in a wider perspective. We all know exactly how much control Deitch has over the transfer window. But to me, how that should work is that, you know, the manager identifies, number one, what area he needs strength in. Where obviously we know now we need creativity, for example, in that side. So he would identify, say, a winger, for example, and he would identify a pool of players. And then for me, he has to then step away. And as long as the players that the board are going for sit within that identified group of players, it then has to be down to the board or whoever they appoint independently of the manager to go and do the negotiations with the club, decide what they're prepared to pay as a club and to set the wages and agree the personal terms and then just confirm to the manager when that appointment's been done. And that's how it happens in most clubs. Now, Deitch's view and his control over the recruitment process is admirable in many respects. And it's a very difficult balance for me because I'm very glad that he is so aware of the restriction on the club finances and he's very aware of his custodian role that he calls it and how much he wants to make sure that there is still a club here after it. But I think that's gone too far. Deitch is very, very old school when it comes to football and he's very vocal about his disappointment with the way that wages have escalated and the agent's role and the phenomenal money that the players are going for. We hear it every single week, who's spent what, we can't spend that. Well, fine, step away from it. You know, don't let that become your role. And I think for me, the Mike Trigg coming in as a director of football is a welcome appointment because I feel like Deitch needs to step away from that role.
I agree. I think there's it's been one area of the club that, you know, you're going into a totally different realm that we've ever been in. And also in terms of casting the net wider as well, because one of the difficulties I think we have had is that we've relied a lot more on domestic players. We've brought in, you know, one or two from abroad, but I think the domestic market, there's not as much value in it. So if we can get someone in who's got, you know, good links and can identify value in players from abroad, then that might be, well, hopefully that's going to be a big positive for the club.
Absolutely. I think moving on, the last couple of points that Becker has put in a list, I'm not going to actually dwell on. I think the fourth point was that whatever it is that's wrong with these players, whether it be tiredness, lack of desire or lack of passion, depending on which camp you fall into, it's obvious that these players aren't running the same, they aren't playing with the same level of intensity, and they're nowhere near the levels they were last season. So many tweets that we were sent last night said exactly the same thing. And actually, I'm not going to dwell on that because it's a point that we've been talking about for weeks in the podcast now, and I don't see much merit in going over that same old ground again and just bemoaning these players' lack of effort. We all know, or perceived lack of effort, sorry. We all know that they're not playing the same level of intensity. We don't know the reasons why. Anything that we offer is purely speculation as to what's going wrong with this club. And let's just hope that this appointment of Richard Trigg, Mike Trigg, it starts on Saturday, as Dave reliably told me in pre-recording, and let's just hope that he gets his feet settled under the table and they get a strategy in place before this January transfer window and we can start to turn this around. I think that's all I've kind of got to talk about on the game. There is also quite a lot of tweets sent to us last night directly asking us if we would discuss on the podcast whether or not Dyche's time is up. I'm going to gloss over this very, very quickly because the answer is no, it absolutely is not. We are nowhere near that stage right now that we can even be thinking about sacking Sean Dyche. I think that's a ridiculous... well, it's not ridiculous. I don't want to be disrespectful to those fans who genuinely believe it, because every paying fan's entitled to their opinion. But for me, we are nowhere near that stage yet. And Sean Dyche has earned the right to be given time. He has earned the right to bring these players back into the fold. He has earned the right to be part of the January transfer window and see what players he needs to bring in. And he's earned the right to try, for me, to keep us in this division. And worst comes to worst, if we fall out of this division, he's earned the right to get us back into it next season. So we aren't going there on this podcast. Thank you very much to all of the fans who did send us that message asking us to discuss it. I don't want to be dismissive of what you've said, and I have respect for your opinion, but it's just not something that I think that we're even going to push as an agenda item on the podcast. So, Dave, I don't have anything else to talk about in terms of the game last night or the perceived problems around the club at the moment, unless you have anything else that you want to add.
No, I think we've covered the game off. We've been through the aspects of it. I think the most important thing is to put that behind us and concentrate on Saturday now.
Yeah, again, that was actually Becca's fifth point that she put in her email, saying the reset button is well and truly broken. We've pressed it three times and it hasn't worked. Well, Becca, we're going to press it a fourth time. We're pressing the reset button here and now. Producer Matt, if you have some kind of buzzer that you can insert into this point of the podcast, please do it now. Okay, listeners, that will either have a nice little point of a buzzer going, be a silence, and I'm just going, oh no, nothing's happened. So let's see what happens there. Right, let's move off the field then. And another point that some of our listeners got in touch with us and asked us to talk about on the podcast was some wider Premier League news. This is a really controversial point that is being discussed and debated across the footballing world, and indeed has already started to be campaigned against by Liverpool fans at their recent game. Outgoing Premier League chairman Richard Scudamore is going to receive a £5 million farewell bonus, and that is going to be raised by a £250,000 contribution to all the current Premier League clubs. It's supposed to be a golden handshake, essentially, which is in recognition of his outstanding work. Now, my God, I've got so many things to go on with this, but we're going to keep it relatively brief. I think my view on this is he has done a fantastic job. He has moulded that Premier League from what it was when it started to the phenomenal business machine that it is today. Whether you are pro or against modern football, you can't argue with exactly how he's changed the face of modern football and what he's done for the Premier League and the clubs who are in it. But he's been paid very handsomely for that. job. He's been paid a salary that most of us will never ever see in our lifetimes. Those salaries will have included bonuses every single year. So the idea that he retires from that job and then gets another £5 million bonus, such a grotesque level, is absolutely beyond me. And this is at a time in the UK where we're still in a period of austerity, albeit the government are trying to pull us out of it. And there are more and more, in fact, record numbers of people across the country are heavily reliant on food banks just to survive. And grassroots and lower league football is at its most difficult phase it's ever been to. So to give one man who's already been paid the money he's been paid a £5 million bonus and then expect the clubs to pay for it as well is just atrocious. Dave, I'm kind of disappointed that Burnley wasn't just rolled over and said, yes, we'll pay it, and we aren't one of the clubs that decided to... We just didn't make a stand.
It was an odd one. Obviously, a lot came out about it in the media, and I think in the end, they kind of rolled back on it. It kind of went from a suggestion, and you know, this may have been a mischievous suggestion to try and get it out of the media, I don't know, but the last I heard, the suggestion was that it wasn't going to be an extra contribution that each of the Premier League clubs would have to make, but it was going to come from some sort of central pot. In some ways, that's irrelevant because the guy looks like he's going to get what he was originally going to get. But they've kind of done it in a different way, and it perhaps isn't, you know, quite as confrontational and controversial as it might otherwise have been. But you know, at the end of the day, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, he's been paid for the job. You know, he'll have got significant bonuses. You know, it's documented out there. There's a couple of the guys on Twitter who post the information out in terms of the finances of clubs and football in general. Kieran Maguire is one of them, and another one, Swiss Ramble as well, who posts a lot of the financial stuff out there. And you know, quantifies the information in terms of what Richard Scudamore has been paid for doing, you know, a very good job. You know, the Premier League's far away ahead in terms of the revenue that it generates compared to comparable leagues of other countries in Europe. So for that, he's done a fantastic job. And I can understand to some extent that there is a worry that if he leaves and yeah, there's no sort of structure in place that he could just go and he could, you know, give his expertise to La Liga or some other league in Europe and do a very similar job for them. So there's kind of a background understanding of that. I think the difficulty is this sort of the way it was presented originally, saying, well, you know, all the 20 Premier League clubs are going to have to stump up a massive amount of money, £250,000 each, to get this £5 million bonus for him. And I think in the end what's happened is he's actually been kept on in some sort of consultation capacity. So the payment's now being spread over 3 years than what it was going to be originally. And he's doing some sort of consultancy, which will be a little bit like a golden handcuffs deal. I guess that's the way it's termed, which is kind of the best of both worlds. I think the amounts of money involved are staggering when you bear in mind it's on top of a salary he was already getting and significant bonuses. Little part of me thinks, yeah, that there's kind of an understanding that if they don't do something, then you know the Premier League and the Premier League clubs might lose out. And it might, you know, the way the TV deals are going, 5 million is a staggering amount of money, but in percentage terms, it's a relatively small amount compared to what TV deals are. You know, these things tend to be negotiated over three seasons, so you know you're talking billions and billions of pounds. So it's a difficult one, and I think it's been handled quite badly, certainly in the way it came out in the media in the first place. And you know, the Premier League really need to be better on its PR, I think. And try and put fans back on side, because you know fans are seeing through this and thinking, well, you know, it's just not right. It's a staggering amount of money, and that's the headline figure, and that's what people see.
Well, that was an impressive summary, Dave. I genuinely feel like no matter what I've got in the world to whinge about, you'll make me feel better. You know, have you ever thought about going into politics? I think you'd make a fantastic politician. That was so, that was a better spin than that write-up that was on the Burnley website last night about last night's game. And that was a pretty good spin, to be fair. Yeah, no, but you make some really good points there, Dave. And I think our view at None and Ever is essentially, yes, we do understand the reasons why. And I think Dave's just highlighted them really well. And you know, this is the modern world that we work in, but we just can't give it our blessing just because of the ludicrous sums involved and just what that money could do for where it's desperately needed in the rest of the country. So we may understand some of the reasons for it, but we do not in any way condone this, and that is our position. Before we move on to preview the next game where Burnley go away to Crystal Palace, we have a little bit of news for those of you who haven't yet noticed. This time next week, well, actually next week, the podcast is going to be out a couple of days later, but we are going to have some live updates for you directly from the Tower of London. We are absolutely delighted to announce that we have been shortlisted by the Football Supporters Federation in their annual awards for Club Podcast of the Year. We are alongside, there's five shortlisted. There is the Watford podcast from the Rookery End. There is this Manchester City podcast, The Blue Moon. There's us. There is the Fulham podcast, The Fulhamish. And there is the Wolves podcast. And they are going to, oh, I'm so sorry, Wolves. I can't remember. And I can't remember off the top of my head what it's called. I think it's just called The Wolves or something. It's the Wolves podcast. So Burnley, Wolves, City, Watford and Fulham have all been shortlisted. And so Robbie and I are heading down to London on next Monday, which is when we normally record the podcast. We're having to get dressed up, listeners. It's going to be a glitzy affair with all sorts of glamour and celebrities there. And me and Robbie are going to be representing the None and Ever podcast in the corner at a gala dinner with a bar and an awards ceremony, and to see if we've won. We don't have massive expectations, just because we know some of the guys who are in our category. We do work with them, and there's some fantastic podcasts out there. But we're going to do our best, and if we win, that would be fantastic. And if we don't, it's absolutely fantastic exposure for the club. Actually, out of all of the categories at the awards next week, the only thing Burnley related is the None and Ever podcast. The club hasn't been nominated both on the playing side or the media side or in any other category. So we need to just make sure we are there. So we will report from the night, weird shoes permitting that I'm going to have to wear. I'm going to have to wear one of them dress things, listeners, with the heels. And so providing I don't fall over and make an idiot of myself, which I'm sure Robbie will probably live tweet anyway. We will let you know next week how we do. So please wish us luck. And we will be recording on Tuesday instead. So the podcast will be out probably Wednesday next week rather than Thursday. So there you go. That's exciting news. But let's not dwell on that, listeners. Let's have a look at Claretts, because we want to get back into the happy, cosy, warm, fuzzy feeling of Burnley winning, especially away from home. And indeed, the next Premier League game next Saturday is Crystal Palace. And Dave, our statistician, as well as preparing to host and be co-host and on the panel this week, has done his regular slot on our head-to-head stats. So Dave Roberts, over to you.
Yeah, well, looking back at the previous games against Crystal Palace, we haven't actually played that many games against them. I think they didn't come into being until 1905, and spent a lot of time in the lower leagues when Burnley were in the top division for a lot of those seasons. So we haven't played them as much as quite a few of the other teams we've played this season. The first game we did play against was in the FA Cup back in 1909. Our first match at, it wasn't at Selhurst Park, so they didn't move there till 1924, but it was actually at the old Crystal Palace ground, which another ground that Burnley had a famous victory at, because that's where the 1914 FA Cup final was played, that Burnley beat Liverpool 1-0. And we actually drew that game 0-0 at Crystal Palace, against Crystal Palace. But that's probably more notable for the replay that Burnley won 9-0, which was a record victory for the Claretts, but we hadn't turned to claret by 1909. So we were still the greens or whites or whatever we were playing in at the time. So that was quite notable. We've actually had 22 matches in total, and we've had five away victories. And when we look back at some of the other teams we've played this season, that's quite a decent return to get five wins out of 22 matches. And the first twice we played them in the, well, first division as it was, we won both those matches. So that's February 1970, we won 2-1. We got a Lachlan own goal, Crystal Palace player, and also Steve Kindon scored for Burnley to make it 2-1. And then a year later in 1971, Burnley had a 2-0 win. By then, Jimmy Adamson had taken over from Harry Potts. And Ralph Coates and Martin Dobson were the Burnley goal scorers that day. Going back through other notable games, more notable from a Crystal Palace perspective was 1979. Crystal Palace needed to win in order to win the second division. They had a record crowd of over 51,000 on at Selhurst Park in May 1979. And the game was 0-0 with about 15 minutes to go. And Crystal Palace, they would have still got promoted, I think, but they would have finished third in the division. That was, you know, well before the playoffs had started. But they scored a couple of late goals and beat Burnley 2-0, were a famous victory for them. And they got promoted as champions that season. So that's one for the Crystal Palace fans to be interested in. And then going forward a little bit to ones that Burnley fans will perhaps be more likely to remember, we had a couple of wins under Stan Ternent in September 2000. Graham Branch scored the only goal for a 1-0 win for Burnley. And then, coincidentally, we're playing on this Saturday, which is the 1st December. And it was the 1st of December 2001. Burnley were at Crystal Palace for a match in the, whatever we called it then, the championship equivalent. And Ian Moore scored two. I think he'd gone on a really barren run. He hadn't scored for about 13 or 14 games. He scored two goals and Burnley won 2-1. That's where the good news ends, because after that, we've played 12 matches, League and Cup, at Crystal Palace. And our only win in those 12 matches was two seasons ago. You'll maybe remember, Natalie, that we had a rather barren run away games in the 2016-17 season. And on the Saturday evening, we were picked for the televised match. And we were, you know, desperate for a win to, you know, try and get us away and try and consolidate our really good home form that season. Burnley managed a 2-0 victory that day. Ashley Barnes and Andre Gray were the goal scorers. For a relief, really, for Burnley fans to get that 2-0 win at Crystal Palace. And obviously Burnley went on to survive that season. And then last season, it's actually early this year, we played them in January. I think Bakary Sakho scored the only goal for Crystal Palace to win 1-0. But yeah, last 12 games, Burnley have only won the once, and that was the one two seasons ago when Ashley Barnes and Andre Gray scored.
It's quite some interesting stats in that, actually. I think, I've got to say, when you first looked at that at the beginning, I'd very much take 9-0 win now. That'd be nice.
That was at home.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll just do 9-0 away. That would be nice. It's quite interesting, actually, when you look at these results. Interesting to see that in the three games that Dyche has managed this Burnley side against Palace, we've only conceded one goal. You know, I mean, I'd take that. I'd take either a clean sheet or just one goal. But, you know, Dyche's record is 1-1, drawn 1 and lost 1. So I think it's time for Dyche to get, obviously, a second win. That would be nice. We don't want to have a second draw. We don't have a second loss. We want that to be two greens on Dave's spreadsheet when we come to do the return fixture at the end of the season. So looking away from the stats, Dave, what's your, I guess, gut feeling about Saturday? I'm feeling like this is going to be the game that we turn it around. I feel like we're going to win. Am I just being ridiculous?
No, I think we need to start winning. We need to get some points on the boards. We do have some really tough games coming up. When you look at the fixtures, then this game coming up and the Brighton game, which is at home, are probably the two you look at and think, well, they're the ones we're more likely to get points out of. I mean, we know there's no easy games in the Premier League, but they're the two that you would think would be easier to get points out of. We've perhaps got to draw on that spirit we got from two seasons ago. We went into the game, we hadn't won an away match all season. We went out there and in front of the cameras got that fantastic victory with Ashley Barnes and Andre Gray came on a sub, didn't he, I think, and smash the ball in for that second goal, and that was a real relief for Burnley fans. So if we get the same result again on Saturday, we'll be delighted.
And what would you do sort of player-wise? I mean, I'm going to assume that JBG is going to be back, that he's over his illness.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, that I think we did miss him a little bit on Monday night.
Oh, yeah, massively.
And I think you know, Robbie Brady is still coming back from an injury. I think it might just give us a bit more balance if JBG is back and available on Saturday. But we've got to be maybe a little bit less reticent. We need to be passing the ball around a little bit better, a little bit more confidence. I think there were, you know, maybe trying to take two or three more touches than we needed to, and you know that kind of, you know, it echoed back on. Maybe it'll help being away, actually. I mean, that perhaps did reflect a little bit on the crowd, maybe the little bit of frustration for Burnley's build-up play that wasn't quite as fluid as maybe we would have liked it to have been. So I think perhaps you can go out with a little bit more confidence when you're playing away from home. We know, you know, Crystal Palace have got their threats. They're you look at how they started last season and how they finished it. You know, they finished 11th in the division. So if you take that first part of the season out of it, you know, they were, you know, they probably got more points than Burnley got if you took that out of the equation. And you know, they've had a reasonable start this season as well. So it's not an easy prospect, we know that, but you know, we've got to start winning somewhere. So you know, what better place to start than Saturday?
Absolutely, and what a way to end the podcast. What better way to start winning than on Saturday? So there you go, Burnley fans, fellow listeners, that concludes this week's podcast. A couple of things for you to look out for in the next couple of weeks. We're going to be joined next week by club commentator Phil Bird, who has written his first book, which we're all very excited about. He's going to be our guest next week on the podcast, and he's going to give us his reaction to the Palace game, a few thoughts on what's happening in the club this season generally, and he's going to tell us all about the process of writing his book, what that means to him, and how you guys can get yourselves hold of a copy. We're going to be running a competition to win one of Phil Bird's books. Hopefully this side of Christmas as well, if we can make it work, we're going to be publishing our one-off special with none other than the Paddy and Predator, Andy Payton, which we're incredibly excited to have him on the show. Again, he's going to be looking at his time at the Clarets and what he's been doing recently, and also give his reaction to the current Clarets setup and how well we seem to be doing at the moment as a club. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks, as ever, go to Robbie for his very small contribution outside the ground, and then for skiving this evening. I think he's at the City game doing work, and he's just sent me an Instagram post where he's sat at a table with a load of glasses of wine and his feet up. So we have some suspicions that known and ever that Robbie might be on a jolly this afternoon. But yeah, thanks anyway, Robbie. Thanks to producer Matt for putting the show together once we finish recording it and producing what it is that you're listening to right now. And thanks, as ever, to my co-host and resident statistician Dave Roberts. My final thanks, as ever, are reserved for you, the listener, for downloading this podcast and for listening to us. Your support is very much appreciated, and we just would not be here without you. We will be here next week on Tuesday as the 2018 Football Supporters Federation Club Podcast of the Year, with a win under our belts away at Crystal Palace. Until next time.